Hello and welcome to Studio One in King's Place, where this week we'll be looking, among other things, at the BMP on Question Time. Of course, we want our listeners to hear the full spectrum of views, of Guardian views that is, the full mix of Social Democrats and Libertarians, so we've got Jonathan Friedland, Henry Porter, and not a Nazi in sight. Well, Henry, I'm going to start with you. First question, not whether you think it's right or wrong, but will you be watching tonight?
Yeah.
And why is that?
Because I think it's an event a journalist should watch. I think probably if I was just a member of the public, I wouldn't watch. Because I disapprove of this man so much. But as a journalist, I think I certainly should watch, and it's an important thing to know about and to witness.
And you agree with that, Johnny?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be watching it too. It's a political moment. You know, there are plenty of events that none of us approve of, but nevertheless, you have to witness them, and this is one of those.
And so you don't approve? You don't think we've got to fight for the right of this man to say what he wants, even if we don't agree with him?
We do. He absolutely should have the right of free speech, but that doesn't mean you have unfettered access to what is in some ways the premier platform in our national conversation. My right of free speech is not impeded. I've never been on Question Time. It's a false notion that everyone has somehow a democratic-born right to be on Question Time. That's not true. It's a selection. There are plenty of programmes on the BBC that actually not only should feature Nick Griffin, but have. He's on Newsnight, he's on the Today programme, he's part of those discussions. But Question Time is of a different order. It is, for one thing, a much larger audience. For another, it is beyond just politics. It isn't that he would then just be scrutinised and discussed on his particular views of the position of the BNP. It is a programme that ranges across the whole national conversation. So there's a very kind of subtly legitimising thing about that. You know, he'll be asked the light-hearted question at the end about, you know, which musical do you prefer, Oliver or The Sound of Music? You know, and that humanises him in a way that actually itself is an editorial and value judgment.
But Henry, isn't the thing that really means that we've got to listen to his views, listen to his voice, that 6% of the people who went out and voted in the European election voted for him, and he got two MEPs?
I still don't think that... this is promoting and dignifying a racist party, a fascist party, a person who goes on the radio yesterday and talks about all criminals as vermin, as if they should be put down. His attitudes, not just about race, but across the board, are absolutely unpalatable. And I believe that we are... It's like putting him in a theatrical position. It's giving him and dignifying the BNP. It's a vast victory for the BNP, this. Whatever happens tonight, it's enormous. It allows them to say, we've arrived. And that is a very, very regrettable moment in British politics. And I agree with Jonathan. It is absolutely not about free speech. This man is never off the radio during election time. He will... he's given all the airtime that is necessary for 6% of the vote. I just believe that Jonathan's completely right. I mean, I find these issues very, very difficult, being pretty much a hardline free speech guy. But I think it's just 51%, 49% in my mind against him appearing. And I think that final 1% is because his views are so absolutely hostile to our free society and our democratic society. And those things, I think, count very... And I think the BBC has just failed to make a good argument and failed to show the leadership and judgment that it should have in these.
But if we were to license the BBC to make these decisions in this case, because we particularly dislike the views of Nick Griffin, what's to stop them blocking the views of, people like Hamas or, in days gone by, the Republicans in Northern Ireland, who other people might say, no, there's no way we should listen to them. We should block them out.
No, but they're not being blocked out.
They're not being,
That's the point. I mean, the Sinn Féin parallel is a very good one because Mark Thompson raises that and says, look, if people don't want this guy on Question Time, you should do what you did with Sinn Féin and have the broadcasting ban. Now, that's a straw man argument because actually the broadcasting ban gagged Sinn Féin from every outlet. They couldn't be on the news. They couldn't be on the Today Record. Couldn't be on Newsnight. You simply could not hear their voices. Now, no one is doing that with Nick Griffin. They're simply saying, in the range of BBC outlets, this one is not suitable. But he still has a chance, absolutely, to air his views. So to suggest to us that the choice is, look, either you have a full wholesale ban, or, I'm sorry, he has to be on Question Time, is a false choice. There can be a free platform for him, but just not on this programme, because this programme, like I say, is a kind of premium... There's something, a very subtle statement that is made by putting somebody on Question Time, which says this person is legitimate. They're part of our mainstream national conversation. We are interested in their views, not just on race, but he's going to have a chance to sound off about Afghanistan, about expenses, all kinds of things that gives him a kind of extra legitimacy, which the free speech argument is disingenuous here because it suggests that there's his free speech would be impaired if the government was coming, closing down his meetings, gagging him and taking him off to jail. That is not happening.
But can I make another point on this? Essentially, the BBC does make judgments about what it wants to or not. For instance, in last February, when I was staging the Convention on Modern Liberty, we could not get... We had 110 speakers, including the DPP, the former lead law lord, Dominic Grieve, and so forth. A very distinguished group of speakers. And we could not get on any BBC programme. And they took a decision. You know, there was a decision taken that this was simply not news or simply not relevant or annoying to the Labour government. Whatever the decision was, there was a decision taken. And this is important because if you're making decisions which allow access to programmes like a Question Time, you can't, on the other hand, say, well, you know, this group of libertarians or these people concerned about liberty shouldn't be on the airways. There are decisions made, and I think they've made completely the wrong one on this way.
But when it comes to Question Time, okay, so they're not banned from every outlet, but what criteria, apart from the vote, are we meant to use? We'd all want to see a Green Party pop up every so often. They get a similar percent of the vote. And if it's this argument about 6% isn't enough, well, if it was 8, 9 or 12%, would the picture change?
Automaticity. I mean, there is in some areas of broadcasting, for example, party election broadcasts. Yeah. A certain share of the vote entitles you to a certain number of minutes of airtime. And the BBC and the others put it on and their hands are tied and nobody, you won't hear Henry or I object to that because that's absolutely where you have a right to free speech and that must go on unfettered. And it is. This is different. This is an absolutely discretionary judgment. As I said, I've not been on. Other people have not been on. There's no automatic right that says in a society of free speech, you haven't been on top. You know, that immediately you get a ticket onto that programme. Yeah. And this notion that there's some kind of threshold, that's invented by the BBC. It doesn't say in the Representation of the People Act, once you clear this hurdle, you get a seat on Question Time. Because why is Tim Rice and Ian Hislop on there? They haven't cleared any hurdle. It's a discretionary editorial judgment. And the other point is that the BBC is absolutely entitled to say some views, while not illegal, nevertheless clash with our position as a public service broadcaster who has to speak to the entire nation, and this is a diverse nation, and a party which still, as a matter of its constitution, not yet changed, bars non-white people, that just clashes with our obligation to speak to the entire country.
Okay, well, let me try a pragmatic argument. I'm obviously not going to convince you that there's a point of high principle here. But what about this idea, Henry? The BNP's got a range of mad policies. We all know about their policies on immigration, but their policy on Ireland, for example, is let's welcome Southern Ireland back within the Union. I mean, sending gunboats up the Liffey. Now, isn't it a good idea for people to see that on Question Time, other people to be able to say you've got mad views on education, mad views on Ireland, on Europe and whatever else, and therefore undermine their credibility? Shouldn't we have the confidence that the force of the argument's going to win out?
Well, by that, I mean, you would have the monster raving loony party on Question Time as well, because it exposes a sort of broad range of insanity. I still think that the crucial argument is not about their range of policies or their range of insane views, but that they are being dignified by the BBC, and there are many other opportunities to expose the flaws and stupidity of their range of views, but this is not one. This is a national platform which has been, I think, sullied by Mark Thompson. I think he's made a very, very bad mistake.
Well, for more Guardian coverage of the Question Time controversy, go to our website and look out for our special BNP edition of Guardian Daily. Next to Royal Mail. The posties have downed tools today, and so there'll be no letters tomorrow. Mike White mailed in this dispatch just in time.
White Noise with Michael White.
What a very British shambles. We virtually invented the postal service. Charles II created Royal Mail. Rowland Hill dreamed up lickable penny stamps. Postal official Anthony Trollope invented the Victorian pillarbox when not writing all those novels. Fast forward a century or so, though, and we find Royal Mail and its trade union, the CWU, locked in a battle over modernisation of its services, a belated attempt to catch up with mainland Europe's high-tech levels of productivity, and blaming each other for failure. It could be a custom-made script for handing over swathes of their business to private rivals to direct debit or the internet. That sort of thing is happening anyway, the result of new technology and botched moves towards market forces, which lifted much of the mail's historic monopoly, but not the final mile, which the traditional postie still delivers. Oh yes, and macho, overpaid bonus culture management led by ex-Saatchi ad man Adam Crozier, whose last job was running that roar-away success, the Football Association. In the boom years, the Treasury filched the profits and the management took a pension holiday. Argh! So what do the posties and sorters do when faced with such an avalanche? Their executive gets tough too. Alpha male stuff, as one friendly MP puts it, despite having a bright leader in Billy Hayes, which is all understandable but not smart when so many impersonal forces are aligned against you. In many less militant areas, unions and managers have quietly introduced new working without fuss. Is the strike going ahead? Last night, the CWU staged a press conference. Peace or war? War, it seems. Union officials accused Lord Peter Mandelson, 56 yesterday, of collusion with management to screw them.
Those people are Mark Higson, the managing director of the company, Adam Crozier, the chief executive for the company, and Peter Mandelson.
Meanwhile, customers find other ways to get the message or the parcel across. Alas, the daily post on the mat is vestigial for many people. When did you last receive a really important communication by post? No, me neither. It's sad, but if the strike deepens, many people won't notice. No Christmas cards? I think I can live with that. But can the struggling Royal Mail?
Michael White there. Johnny, the political question here is who's going to get the blame and who deserves to get the blame?
Well, right now the blame is going very much, I think, on the unions, and they have in a way played their part as if from central casting. Billy Hayes, a rather unfortunate comparison himself to Arthur Scargill, and just the language really of dispute from the 1970s, that cliche which is getting very, very tired now, but comparing any old-fashioned Labour strike to the 1970s, it does work for the other side. Mm. And so in the PR battle, I fear actually that the Postal Workers Union have sort of walked into a caricature of themselves and at the moment on the losing end. That's the reason why I say I fear is because I think they actually have more of a case than that cliche allows, in the sense that they are the ones saying let's go to ACAS, the arbitration service, another word from the 1970s, and it's the employer backed by the government saying no, first of all you've got to call off the stoppage, and also they say look, we've actually done quite a bit for modernisation, including losing 60,000 plus jobs in recent years. So they have a point, but right now it's managed to play in a two-dimensional way of caricature with reasonable modernising slick-suited management and a sort of dinosaur trade union. That's a cliche, but it's the one that at the moment is prevailing and needs to be busted, I think.
And what do you think, Henry? I mean, is this a new Labour case of lack of imagination? They've got a public service, they've run it as a business, and the workforce have had enough.
I think, just to answer your first question about who's going to be blamed, I think the government will be blamed. And I think rightly, too. I think Mandelson should have stepped in by now. I think their whole legislative strategy on the privatisation was absolutely appallingly handled.
They linked the privatisation to all the other stuff, like the pension deficit, didn't
absolutely.
They? There was no need for a link.
And this is an essential service, and also, I think, a rather good one. I have extreme affection for the postmen. You know, you get used to two or three over the course of a year. Great people, work really hard, and I have a complete sympathy for them, and I think they've been thoroughly messed around. I also think the Communication Workers Union should have handled their case, as Johnny says, much better. These days, they should get somebody to handle that case for them. They should have a proper PR. They should have a spin doctor, because you can spin this case two ways. And they have a good deal of meat and a good deal of right on their side. And they failed to present that to the public, who just see this as a sort of 1970s-style inconvenience. Is a disaster. And when Mike Wright says that the last time you had anything important delivered in your mail, he's completely wrong. Hundreds of companies get their checks in the mail, their orders in the mail.
All our Amazon stuff now.
Absolutely. It's a very important service, and Mike, I think, did a disservice to it by saying that, you know, when did you last get something important in the mail? It's absolutely nonsense. The whole of this business and people's relationships work on a very important and valuable and brilliant, I think, postal service.
And there is something progressive about it too, which is that we should preserve, which is the it is a flat rate, so that even people in very remote rural areas who under this private, if we, that's the way we're moving to sort of courier services, the person on a croft in Scotland who wants to send a Christmas card is going to have to drive to some post office or some courier head office and spend £9-10 to send a letter. Right now it's flat rate, the same as to people in London from a few streets away posting a letter to each other. That is a progressive thing that we would lose if we moved to this courier service. And you notice the people who are the advocates for it, particularly in the sort of London-based commentariat, they're sitting there and they're in central London, where courier services are fine for them. For other people, though, they do rely on it in exactly the way Henry was describing, as a public service, keeps them connected. A postman who comes, the letterbox at the end of the street means they can send things without paying some huge rate. You know, Robert Reich, who was Labour Secretary for Bill Clinton, wrote a book called The Secession of the Successful, describing how rich people were seceding from all the daily practices. You know, they were not on buses, they were in limousines, their children went to private schools, and they got their mail couriered, and they got their copy of the Wall Street Journal hand-delivered by courier in the morning. For those people, they can cope without a post office, which seems probably quaint and backward. But for everybody else, it is one of those ties that bind and that we need, and I think there could have been a very good public case, a popular case, made for it, if it had been framed not in terms of sort of grumpy union, but in terms of a valuable pressure service that people want.
Do you think, though, just look at the Scargill parallel for a minute, there's two things here, aren't there, that arguably do make a link. One is, in the very long term, even if Henry and yourself are still getting the odd occasional thing that's of value in the post, in the long term, we're all using email more, text message more, and therefore letters less. And so it probably is a declining industry. And secondly, there's a government, like Thatcher in the 80s, taking on the mines. There's a government now that's brought in European rules earlier than it had to, hell-bent on competition and reducing the cost of letters for central London businesses, that's quite happy to see the industry wither on the vine. And so doesn't that make the Scargill parallel quite strong?
Well, it does, in the sense that they're vulnerable. But on the other hand, they do have the odd thing about what's happened with internet technology is that it has both posed a threat to the regular post and given it a new lease of life simultaneously. I mean, Mike was joking there about when's the last time anything important. I notice now the buzzer goes when I'm writing at home more often than it ever used to, with parcels being delivered because of online shopping.
Right.
I mean, so things that we never used to get through in the mail, you know, I had to buy a chain to lock my bicycle. The cheapest way of doing it was online. And that arrived in the post. That would never have been something the postman would have delivered before. I'd have gone to a shop to get it. So actually, we are depending on it more in some ways, but I agree, that bit of the business has now been diversified. Other people, there's competition there. But there's no reason, partly because of that point about the flat rate promise, the guarantee that it's the same wherever you are, that's a progressive thing that we should hold on to. Otherwise, like I say, you know, there will be no reason for it not to be the case that the person sitting in Scotland who wants to get something to London has to pay way, way more than they currently pay. And it's one of those things that makes us a single country rather than, you know, lots of little individuals doing their own thing.
You know, when my old friend Alan Johnson, who's now Home Secretary, when he was leader of the Postal Union in the 1990s, it had one of its only victories, the only victories against privatisation the union movement had during the whole of the Thatcher major years. And he was very savvy because he employed Tim Bell, who was the Conservatives' own sort of spin doctor, advertising guru, and brought them in and said, right, you go and sell the case against privatisation. You know how to get inside the Conservative conference. And you just sort of think, you listen to Dave Ward, we heard there on that clip with Mike White, and you think, you can't quite imagine him doing that somehow.
No, that's right. I think that was very sensible, what Henry was saying too, about, you know, you hire some spin doctors. But on this issue, privatisation, there is a huge amount of common ground between New Labour and the Conservatives, and therefore there probably is a similar or single PR strategy that would work for both of them. They've fended it off thus far, but this does feel as if it could be a turning point against them unless they learn how to make their case. So it plays on what is still a basic public sympathy and affection for the post office. Notice during the banking crisis, when people talking about what's a possible solution, the notion of using the post office as a people's bank, immediately people like that. There's a degree of trust there. What the postal workers have to do is somehow fuse their own identity with the identity of the post office so that they benefit from that affection.
You can see how it's being used by the Conservatives to attack Brown. I mean, Brown looked very weak yesterday and didn't manage to defend himself at all. And this is because the government has been so unclear about what it's going to do with the post office. Presumably, it's not going to be their problem. But there still is a structural debate to happen. which doesn't get into the public domain.
Well, all the kind of nuts and bolts of the post office dispute and what the solutions are covered in this week's The Business, which you can find on the podcast section of The Guardian's website. But here on Politics Weekly, that's all we can fit in this time. So thanks to Henry and Jonathan for venturing into the pod and to Francesca Panetta for producing. I'll be back, hopefully reunited with my dear Allegra, in a mere 7 days' time. Until then, goodbye.